This is the podcast of the Lead Centre Vedanta Studies.
I'm Matthew Traherne, and I'm absolutely delighted to introduce a new set of podcasts, Conversations on Dante, where I discuss some of the many diverse projects around the world which are changing the way in which we think about Dante, his works, his context, and the rich ways in which Dante has played a role in the cultures of the world up to the present day. In this first episode, I discuss an absolutely fascinating project led by George Corbett and Patricia Kelly at the University of St Andrews. George and Patricia are working on a translation of Pierre Mandonnet's book, Dante the Theologian, published in French in 1935. As we discuss, it's a book which has been largely forgotten by Dante scholars, not least because key aspects of its argument were torn apart just a few years later by Étienne Gilson. But George and Patricia want to get us talking about Mandonnet again. This book marks both a particular, very rich moment in Catholic theology, but it also is a way for us to question some of our long-standing assumptions about Dante, about Dante's own life and his formation, and about the role Beatrice plays in his works. The project is supported by the School of Divinity at the University of St Andrews and by the Carnegie Trust. And here at the Lead Centre for Dante Studies, we've really enjoyed being able to take part in the project as it's been developing through a series of workshops. I've found it absolutely fascinating hearing about Mandonnet from George and Patricia, and I'm sure you will too. We're obviously not able to get together in person at the moment. This is late May, so we're currently in lockdown. So I'm calling from Leeds. George is just outside St Andrews, and Patricia's up on the North Yorkshire Moors. So really nice to be able to chat this morning. So thanks very much for taking the time, George and Patricia.
Thank you.
Do you want to begin by just perhaps describing the project, how you envisage this translation looking, what you think are the important aspects of the project?
Yes, I mean, the first thing to say really is that at least I came to Mandonnet's Dante Theologian secondhand, indirectly, And that was through Étienne Gilson's book, Dante and Philosophy, or Dante the Philosopher, as it came out in English translation, which is still, I think, on undergraduate reading lists. And I think most people who are scholars of Dante will have read it. And what intrigued me about that book, which is very interesting in its own right, is that there's another book that lies behind it. There's another thesis that lies behind it. And that's Mandonnet's book, Dante the Theologian. But whereas people read Gilson, almost nobody seems to read Mandonnet's book, and it seems to have sort of got lost. And I was intrigued by this and got a sort of copy on Amazon at great expense. And I just thought, gosh, there's so much interesting material in here. And Mandonnet's thesis is so interesting. Wouldn't it be great for more people in Dante studies to read it? And so for quite a long while now, I've been trying to find a way to do that. And then it was just a delight, really, kind of serendipity that Patricia came to St Andrews to speak about something else. And then I discovered that not only was she a specialist in French, but also precisely in that context, the 1930s ressourcement theologian with an interest in Mandonnet. And so this just seemed the perfect opportunity to kind of work together to try and bring out an edition in English, which I think is important, but also an edition which really tried to do justice to Mandonnet's arguments and to the richness, really, of his scholarship. And we're really excited to try and present that to a new audience through this project.
That's wonderful. So the texts that we're talking about by Étienne Gilson and by Pierre Mandonnet, they're both published in the mid-30s. In French.
Yes, well, and that's the kind of other thing. There was a sort of element of poetic justice here, because Mandonnet actually, or Dante the Theologian, is published in French, comes out in 1935, the year before he dies. So it really reflects him as a mature scholar, someone who's who'd written a lot on medieval philosophy and theologian, a Dominican Thomist, with, I suppose, an amateur passion for Dante, but someone, it's very clear when you read this text that he's read everything by Dante. I mean, including Questio di Aqua Terra, de Monarchia, de Vulgari Eloquenzi, all the vernacular works. He does really know Dante, even if he's not a specialist. But Gilson writes his polemical refutation, Dante and Philosophy, after Mandinet dies. So that comes out in 1939. Mm. And so, you know, Mandinet never had the right to reply. And basically, all the critics kind of celebrated Gilson and wrote off Mandinet. So I think there's an element here of where it's kind of, you know, a bit of the sort of underdog with Mandinet. He didn't have a right to reply. And it would be nice to put the other side forward, as well as just the sense that, you know, there really is really interesting material in Mandinet, and the very fact that Gilson would base his entire book essentially as a refutation of Mandinet suggests that, you know, this is work he took seriously, even though he disagreed very strongly with a number of its conclusions and approaches.
Patricia, I wonder if you'd be able to give us a bit of an introduction, I suppose, into Mandinet himself, his background, the sort of theological interests that he had, and maybe say a little bit about what drew you to this particular text and to Mandinet himself.
Yes, I first came across Mandinet about 15 years ago, and when I was doing my MA thesis on Dominicans and Cathars. Mm. And Mandinet was really the first proper historian of the Dominican order. He wrote his great Life and Works of St. Dominic in the 1930s. And so when George approached me about this project, I was absolutely thrilled to go back to work with Mandinet. He is a really important scholar, born in the 1850s in France, dies in 1936, literally months after Dante the Theologian is published. You know, it's published late in 1935 and he dies in January 1936. So as George says, the fact that he never has the opportunity to respond to Gilson is very unfair. He's a great historical scholar of the medieval period. He's very well known for his work on Siger of Brabant, who, of course, was behind all the controversies at the University of Paris. Very important for a Dominican scholar, because that's what nearly ended up with St. Thomas Aquinas being condemned as a heretic. So Mandinet's main, well, the work that he's principally known for, really, is his great work on Siger. He did a lot of work on identifying authentic works of St. Thomas, and also the life and works of St. Dominic. His context is really interesting because he's writing at a time when the French church has completely separated from the French state. So the French religious are quite, they're exiled, essentially. He's one of a number of really important scholars who predate what we call resourcement theology, which is the theology going back to the sources of our theology, reading the texts in full. People like Lagrange, who founds the biblical school in Jerusalem, Berthier, who wrote, translates Dante into French, and Coconier as well, and Mandinet. So they're all important scholars at the same time, going back to the sources, trying to identify real works. And as George says, one of the things which is clear is he knows Dante inside out, in the Italian as much as in the French.
So I wonder if it would be possible to have a bit of a flavour of what the main arguments are that Mandinet is putting forward around Dante. As you've said, George, some of them are quite interesting, surprising perhaps to people who used to modern scholarship on Dante. Could you maybe talk us through the main aspects of those arguments?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, one thing which is immediately striking about the way that Mandinet structures his book, Dante the Theologian, it's very Thomistic. He orders it according to the four causes. And he says, what are the four causes of Dante's poem, the Commedia? Well, you've got the efficient cause, the author. And so the first part is about Dante. Then you've got the final cause. What's the purpose? And that's the second part of short part of the book where he says, well, it's to the glory of God, it's to convert sinners, etc. And then the third part then is on the formal cause, the form. And this is where you get really interesting digressions on medieval hermeneutics and then the material cause, talking about the sort of matter of the poem. Now, that first part on the efficient cause, Dante, the author, is the one that the reviewers picked up on. And it's the one which includes Mandone's very controversial thesis about the Vita Nuova, and in particular about Beatrice. Not only does Mandone think that there was no historical Beatrice, there was no Bici Portinari, that Beatrice has a function in all Dante's vernacular works, which is pure symbol, pure allegory. But he also has this more sort of quixotic interpretation that Dante was a cleric, and that what the Vita Nuova is telling us really is a story of the failure of his clerical career, that he started clerical studies, he became a cleric, and that's how he was able to develop the kind of knowledge that he did in those years. He then abandoned that vocation, which corresponds to the death of Beatrice. And then he kind of refines a new way to exhibit that vocation as a lay person, a married lay person, but now an exile. So almost returning to the clerical state in terms of his mode of life, and preach through writing the Commedia. And it's that clerical interpretation that Gilson completely sort of ravages. But also when you look at some of the early reviews, that's kind of what they pick up on. And I think that the problem with that is that then the sort of that skewed the interpretation of the book as a whole. I was personally drawn to the broader general interpretation of Beatrice as purely symbolic. And I think one of the ways in which this project's so interesting for contemporary Dante studies is that we've had this great reappraisal of Dante's theology, you know, much of it spearheaded by you guys in the Leeds Dante Centre. And I've kind of felt that Beatrice has kind of been this the elephant in the room. At one point, Mandone refers to her basically as a sacred cow, even in his that you couldn't touch Beatrice. What's very interesting in the 30s is that the idea that Beatrice is pure symbol itself isn't a problem. People are aware of that as one of different interpretations. The thing that people take issue with is the clerical interpretation. And one of the ways in which this project might reignite engagement is precisely by reopening the question of Beatrice. Because I think some contemporary scholars have put quite a lot of weight on the historical Beatrice, and you read an introduction to Dante and it'll just say Beatrice Portinari was born in Florence. This is, and actually there's not that much documentation or evidence from that outside Boccaccio. And I think in the 1930s, people took very different opinions and views on this matter, but there was no sense that it had been closed up in a way that has happened in contemporary Dante studies. And one of the things which interests me is, but how have we got to this stage? Has there been some final document which has been discovered, which has proven it? And my sense is that maybe that hasn't. So, I mean, that's just one area. I think there are so many areas about this book which are interesting for contemporary Dante studies. But one area that it does certainly open up is the Beatrice question. And because Mandone starts by thinking about Dante's autobiography and thinking about the Vita Nuova, the Convivio and the Commedia as the three autobiographical works, and trying to give a coherent reading of those, that's also what the initial reviewers picked up on. And I think that's still very valuable, but there's also these other three parts of the book which are extremely interesting for other reasons as well.
It really shows Mandone as a scholar of the medieval church, because he's very aware of the fluidity of the nature of the clerical state in the medieval period. So you could start being a cleric, you could be a porter or a lector, but that doesn't involve celibacy. It doesn't involve the commitment to celibacy. It's not like lifelong. You can almost go in and out of the clerical status in a way that I don't think we're familiar with today. And certainly, you know, by the 20th century, that wasn't the case either. So it really shows him coming up against scholars, literary scholars, if you like, against theologians. Maybe there needs to be more of a bridge. And I feel that Mandinay is offering a sort of bridge between the two, the church history and the literary history, which is an interesting aspect.
I think one of the really exciting things about your project to bring this text sort of back to life is that, you know, all of these aspects, not just of the kind of arguments and the ideas that Mandinay is trying to advance, but also the approach he's taking to doing so, really worth revisiting, really important challenge to some of the assumptions that we've kind of landed on. Over the years, and most people who read Dante now, if they came across Mandinay, it would only be through as a kind of foil to Gilson, and so we lose such a lot, that's why I think this is such an exciting project. But I guess that also means, in terms of translating the text, making it accessible to contemporary readers now, but also being faithful to that context in which he's writing, you know, I mean, it makes it quite a challenging enterprise, I imagine. Patricia, do you want to say something about what you see, what you found to be the main challenges in translating Mandinay?
Yes, sure. I think the first thing, it sounds obvious, but he's dead. So I can't email him and say, well, I'm thinking this, but maybe you mean that. So that's a little bit of a problem. I should say that compared to some theologians I've translated, he's very clear. I know that we've discussed some terms and some ways of translating, but relatively speaking, for a French academic of his generation, he's actually a very clear, lucid writer. For me, the biggest problem is that I'm not a Dante scholar, so I can't always make sense of what he's saying, because he's obviously alluding to something Dantean that I'm not familiar with. And of course, there's the ambiguity that is nature, that's the natural state of the French language. There's a reason it's the language of diplomacy. It's because it's full of ambiguity. It's very slippery. You don't necessarily come down on one side or the other. French is ideal for sitting on the fence. So it's not always very clear what he means. And occasionally we come across these slightly made up terms. And we have to, though he has his trinisme, nobody else in the world has used that. He clearly doesn't want to use the Christian doctrinal term of Trinity. Uh-huh. He's obviously made that decision. So we can't use Trinity.
Right.
So are we going to use triplicity? Are we going to use three in oneness? How are we going to translate this made-up term?
So this is a word that he uses in the text itself.
That's
right. Trinisme.
Trinisme.
And is it referring specifically to the uses of the number three in numerology in Dante? Is that where it appears?
That's right. There's also the implicitness behind it of the Trinitarian nature of the Christian God.
But he doesn't use those terms.
He doesn't use those terms, but on the other hand, he doesn't use Trinity and Trinitarian. On the other hand, he doesn't use sort of thrice-ness or any triplicity. You know, there are terms that he could use, but no, he must make up his own. So that's a little bit of a challenge, but we've had fun with that, I think.
And it's quite an interesting neologism. I mean, it's not unorthodox. It's more he's saying that Dante is always meditating, also formally in his work, on the great central mystery of the Christian faith, that God is one and three. And that's what he's meaning by that. And he's just saying that in terms of the formal arrangement of the Terzine, etc., there's always this play between God is one in three persons. And that's important structural principle for Dante. And it's, you know, other terms come up, which, I mean, I love the fact in an early note, you have a reference to Aristotle's use of the term philomythes, that Mandane brings in relation to Dante, mm-hmm. someone who's a lover of myth. But it, you know, amuses me because, you know, it makes you immediately think of Pat Boyd's book, Philomythes and Philosopher, where he tries to bring Philomythes into the English dictionary. You know, this mm. word is a kind of, and, you know, who knows, there may be a place for Mandane's neologism here. I mean, the reason he coins it is because he feels there isn't a word that really does mm. that says both one and Trinity, you know, is sort of exploring that mystery in a formal structural way.
Well, of course, Dante himself is not afraid of creating new words where he feels appropriate ones. And with, I mean, I suppose that's just one example of the kind of thing that you know, that there isn't, not ever going to be a single perfect translation strategy for that kind of thing. And I guess I know that you're both thinking a lot about the kind of apparatus that should surround the translation in the published version of this. And do you want to say a little bit about what you're thinking in terms of what sort of supporting material you'd want to include?
So we're producing a lot of notes, some shorter than others, none of which will be obviously the definitive article, but which will give some background. So ideas around the clerical status in the medieval period, the tonsure and what that indicates or doesn't indicate, ideas about biblical exegesis, how the scriptures were read, and indeed how the fathers were read in the medieval period. Because that's how Mandane is structuring his argument. He's structuring it as a theologian. And for people who are coming to Dante, they haven't necessarily come from a theological background. So there will be quite a lot of apparatus that offers some introduction or a brief introduction to ideas from church history. Then, of course, George's introduction.
Yes, and I think that's right. And I think you know, this is where it's so valuable, also Patricia's expertise, because as she was saying, I mean, Mandane is just such a learned scholar, and in some ways wears that learning quite lightly, and he'll refer to something, even something very central in his argument, but he won't necessarily fill it out with the detail or substantiation which would make his claim a bit stronger. And I think, as Patricia's just been saying, whether it's with regard to the nature of the clerical state, maybe a contemporary Dante scholar might immediately rule out Mandane's hypothesis, but an anachronistic understanding of how education was structured in this period. And I think this kind of using also Mandane's own scholarship on the period, whether it's on the Dominicans or on scripture, but filling that out, I think, will be useful. And we had an early workshop actually in St. Andrews, and Zig Baranski was there, Alison Cornish was there, Claudia Rosignoli was there. It's very helpful. And we were thinking about this project. And I think, was it Zig, Patricia, who helped sort of clarify for us the use of the appendices, very much like the Derling and Martinez edition to their to the poem, where we can do these sort of notes at the end, which hopefully will be useful in their own right, as well as complementing the translation. And yes, then in the introduction, what I'm going to try and do there is really bring some of the major arguments of Mandane and put them in relation to Gilson in his own time, but also to contemporary Dante scholarship. And maybe there's clearly got to be a section then on Beatrice. Another thing we haven't yet mentioned, but which I think is fascinating context, is that the battle, if you like, and that's how I see it, between Gilson and Mandane. Mandane's dead, which is why I think it's fair, but over Dante, this spat, if you like, which Gilson's Dante and philosophy, and then Mandane's, no, Dante the theologian. That represents a kind of cultural spate, but that's part of a much broader and, in a sense, fundamentally more significant debate in the 1930s about the nature of Catholic theology and the relationship between philosophy and theology, the natural and supernatural order, nature and grace. And one of the things which is so interesting there is that in those critical debates, Mandonnet and Gilson were antagonists. Mm-hmm. So before Gilson comes and attacks Mandonnet's reading of Dante, he's been an antagonist against Mandonnet's understanding of Aquinas and understanding of the relationship between philosophy and theology in particular. And I think, you know, that's just so, so important and so interesting. That context is so important. And again, part of this project is aimed at Dante scholars, but part of it, we hope, will also be of interest to theologians who are ever more kind of looking back to those debates in the 1930s and kind of reconsidering some of those questions. In the introduction, that's one of the key contexts I really want to flesh out as well. The debate about Dante is part of a broader debate about Aquinas and Catholic theology. And indeed, one of the things that Gilson really wants to point out in his book is that Dante is so different from Aquinas. But one of the things you might ask is it Gilson's Aquinas or is it Aquinas himself? Because his own interpretation of Aquinas, just as he has his own very contentious understanding of Christian philosophy, which would nonetheless more or less win the day. Now, as theologians, we're kind of looking back to that and thinking, well, was he right? And certainly Mandonnet was in the opposing camp there.
I mean, that's a really important, it ties into, as George has said, a whole load of other debates about where you do theology, who does theology, is theology exclusively for clergy and religious, or can lay people do it? Mm. And obviously in the French context, French state universities don't have departments of theology or religion. They do have religion under anthropology or sociology. But if you want to do theology, you're doing it within an ecclesial context. So that's already, you know, setting up a debate. And Mandonnet is adamant that there's no such thing as Christian philosophy. Philosophy provides tools which theologians can use to help them understand the divine mysteries. But there's no such thing as Christian philosophy. And he's saying, well, what Gilson calls Christian philosophy is what we call theology. It's the use of philosophical tools and reason in order to understand the mystery.
It's such an interesting context. And I think this is part of the power of what you're trying to achieve, really, is that you are both wanting to bring this text to an audience today so that people can engage with some of the ideas that have been lost, even if everybody doesn't agree with everything that's in there, and people can at least engage with things in Mandonnet's text. But also, you only do that by taking seriously the context of the 1930s, which is one where, you know, these debates within Catholic theology are hugely important and are critical to, if you want to give Mandonnet a voice today, which is part of what you're trying to do, you have to understand what that voice was in its original context.
That, in a sense, affects the translation. So one of the things that we decided very early on was that we wouldn't try and make it a 2020 translation. I mean, we would. But that consciously I'm following Mandonnet's style. So it is a work of its time. Had he written it now, he would have written it in a different way. Mm. So I don't want to make it too heavy and too dense. Mm. But at the same time, I am deliberately writing or translating into a slightly more old-fashioned English, I suppose, than I might otherwise.
Yeah, and I think that is so critical that, as you say, Matthew, on the one hand, we're thinking about Mandonnet's interpretation of the 13th, 14th centuries and Dante within that, but we are also, we're very interested in that period in which he's writing the 1930s. And it is so crucial, as Patricia points out, that Mandonnet is a cleric. He's a Dominican. Gilson is a married man. He's a layperson. And Mandonnet wants to interpret Dante as a cleric who has a love for theology symbolized by Beatrice. Gilson, from the more lay side of things, is wanting to interpret Beatrice through the kind of late 19th century romantic tradition. I mean, he still obviously understands it symbolically, so he's not going to some of the extremes of realist positions. But precisely who they were and the context in which they were living absolutely does mediate their interpretation. And I think, you know, what Patricia's been doing so interestingly in her translation as well is exactly that, trying to give us a sense of Mandinay's voice and of the preconceptions which surround that voice. But what I would add there is I think that's a challenge to us today. What preconceptions do we have when we come to read Dante? And in unpicking and being critical towards those of Mandinay, we also are forced to be critical to our own. Because it may well be that the kind of context that Mandinay, and are still there, as Patricia just said, you know, you don't teach theology unless you are in a theology faculty and you would be a religious or a clerical. Is that actually closer to Dante's context than to our own, where any person can, doesn't matter if you're married or you're not? And of course, that's one of Mandinay's argument as a historian, that it would be very strange for someone to be studying theology in the way that Dante obviously did from an early age, if you weren't destined towards or looking towards a clerical vocation. And I think that's a real interesting challenge for us today as well.
Yeah, and I think from, you know, from what I've seen of the translation, it's certainly going to bring a number of those challenges to the fore, whether it's in terms of the question of Dante and the clergy. Beatrice, we've talked about a little bit, where at first sight his ideas seem very kind of at odds with a lot of the orthodoxy today. But actually, when you engage with the way he's thinking about them, you might not end up agreeing with him, but you do have to go back to your assumptions, as you say, and to kind of question them and think about the orthodoxies that we've inherited that we don't challenge as much as we could.
One of the weaknesses, I think, of Mandinay's text is that he doesn't always spell out fully his conclusions, or he doesn't always show his working, as it were. And whether that's because he feels that it's so obvious, or whether that's because it's obvious to him, so why isn't it obvious to everybody else? Or it's difficult to know why he doesn't do that, but that has certainly weakened his text, and I'm sure that's had an impact on his reception as well.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, the other point there is that I think the reviewers were also quite unfair, because Mandinay does present some of his arguments with different levels of plausibility. And, you know, I mean, particularly Gilson, but also some of the earlier reviewers just quickly jump on some of his more quixotic interpretations. And he also does make, I think, a few mistakes, just in terms of interpretation of certain lines of Dante. But, you know, he's quite open about the fact that some of his arguments have more plausibility than others, and also that he's not providing a full interpretation. He's just giving, in a sense, a suggestion. I think the other thing that, you know, Patricia and I, you know, would want to make clear is it's not like we are just gunning for Mandinay here. It might sound like that. Or we're trying to argue that he's right about these things necessarily. But what we are saying is that the ideas that he's opening up are really interesting, and the debate about Dante, but also more broadly about theology, the relationship between theology and philosophy, these are really interesting debates. And by bringing this text to the present with this scholarly apparatus, we can open up those ideas and that scholarship without necessarily coming down one way or the other, but sort of contributing to that dialogue. And, you know, one of the fascinating things that strikes me about contemporary Dante scholarship is some of the big trends, you know, the reappraisal of Dante's theology, Dante's intellectual formation, Dante as a preacher. You read this text in the 1935 and it's all there. He's doing the same thing. He has a chapter on Dante's intellectual formation. he wants obviously to present Dante as a theologian. That's the title of the book. He's very interested in thinking about Dante's style in terms of contemporary preaching. So there's so much there. And I think he also does provide sources that maybe aren't as examined even in some of the very good work which is being done at the present. And Patricia's already mentioned him as a great scholar of the Dominican order. And that's one way where he can really be very precise about what kind of knowledge would have been where and when, based on his extensive archival studies.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I've found really inspiring about talking with you about the project generally is this the way it offers a kind of challenge to any easy narrative that we might have about the progress of our understanding of Dante. So this idea that, you know, a debate takes place in the 1930s and is done and dusted, and we know the outcome and we move on, which is kind of what seemed to happen with the way, you know, Gilson responds to Mandonnet, and Gilson's text becomes dominant and is widely read and Mandonnet's is not. And you're really challenging that, taking the debate on its own terms again, is a great way into thinking afresh questions that are live today. And I just think it's a really beautiful and fascinating model for how we might think about scholarship. So George and Patricia, that's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. It's really appreciated that, I really appreciate the way you're willing to share your thinking at this stage, with me and with people listening to this. I'm sure everyone's going to be really excited about seeing the translation when it comes out. Such an interesting project, and I know it's going to provoke a lot of interest and discussion. So thank you very much for today's discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Matthew.
I hope you enjoyed the first of our conversations on Dante, a new series part of the Leeds Dante podcast. We've got a number of other conversations lined up in the coming weeks and months, and I'm really appreciating the chance to get to know colleagues' work a little bit better and to share in some of the excitement, enthusiasm and insight that they're bringing to the study of Dante. Do please look out for those podcast episodes as they start to come out. And in the meantime, I'd just like to say thank you very much indeed for listening.